You're listening to The Comedy Cellar, live from the table on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Comedy Cellar Show here on Sirius XM Channel 99. We're without Dan Natterman this week.
It's
hard.
Not the same.
It's not the same not without the same. Dan Natterman. But we have Perry L., our producer, and new booker is going to sit in. On my right, we have Dean Edwards, who's a New York City-based stand-up comedian who was a former cast member of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, and I'm gonna channel Dan Natterman tonight.
That's pretty good.
That's what I'll do. I'll channel Natterman.
And our guest of honor is Kevin Nealon, is an actor and comic. He will be performing at Caroline's on Broadway from February 28th to March 2nd. His CBS TV series, Man with a Plan, airs on Monday nights, and his series, Hiking with Kevin, is available on YouTube. He will also be appearing on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon on Thursday, February 28th. Welcome, Kevin Nealon.
Oh, I'm out of breath just hearing all that. That's a lot of work.
So before we talk about other things, you know that my first time I met you was that you used to come to see my band in the Café Wa.
Loved your band.
And I try to convince people I actually had a really good band and it was a whole thing and nobody believes me.
So good, man.
It was good, right?
It was so good. You play the electric guitar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're so good. Who did you grow up listening to? Was it like Clapton and stuff?
The Beatles.
Beatles.
Beatles and Stevie Wonder were my
Beatles
main.
Beatles and Stevie Wonder.
Main diet. And classical music. I was never into all those like Hendrix and Clapton and all those guys. I mean,
really?
I was aware of them. I listened to them sometimes.
What happened to that band? Wasn't the lead singer like blonde hair or something?
They went separate ways. They got old.
It's hard to get up down those stairs, Café Wa, isn't it? Yeah. After a certain age?
They didn't get that old. And then afterwards, we had other people join, and then they left. Like, one of them is the main lead singer with Adele now. Another one's touring with Christina Aguilera. So we had a lot of... Anyway, they're all gone, and I'm just playing acoustic here. Anyway, so
but y'all jam on the weekends, huh?
Yeah, it's all right, huh?
You played on the same stage as Jimi Hendrix.
That's right. I played on the same stage as Jimi Hendrix. I actually also, John Mayer was here one night, and he took a bunch of us over to Electric Ladyland Studio, where Hendrix used to record.
Nice, yeah.
And he had one of Hendrix's original Strats, the one that he used to record Little Wing.
Of course. Of course.
And he let me play it. So, which was, you know...
I have a guitar that I bought from, you know, Danny Farrington. He's a luthier. He makes great guitars, acoustic mostly. He gave me a guitar. It was a reworked Martin guitar, small parlor size Martin.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be a tenor, but he took the neck off and he made it a six string. And apparently George Harrison took that guitar to Fiji with him and had it for a while and then brought it back. And now I have it. So it's got a little bit of George Harrison finger sweat on the fretboards.
Sometimes I see on like eBay or something or somewhere they're auctioning some Beatle paraphernalia that seems within a almost reasonable price.
Yeah.
And I'm always tempted to buy something like that. But I, you know,
why don't you? What holds you back last minute if you're tempted to?
I don't know. You don't want to start collecting stuff. Yeah.
That's a real rabbit hole when you start collecting things, because then people start stealing you stuff, and then you got to get a storage unit. And when you die, they'll just throw it away.
Because sometimes you'll see things for like $7,000-$8,000 or something like, so you know, not even like, you know, and say, what, maybe, you know.
Would you buy one of the outfits from the Sgt. Pepper's band for $8,000?
Absolutely. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's what a regular jacket costs now anyway.
Yeah, I would definitely buy that. I would buy that for $20,000, I think. But that, I think, would go for much more than that.
How much would you pay to have Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney give you a back massage, but just beating different Beatles songs, and you have to figure out which ones they are?
$35,000.
$35,000. 10 songs. That's it.
Yeah, $35,000. Not a penny more.
And what side would you want a Ringo on?
Which side? He plays lefty, so I guess I got to be on my right side. I don't know how that works. All right, so she gave us some topics here, but...
don't believe that.
So, but the bottom one is Kevin's choice, which I think is a nice thing to talk about. Are you into politics these days? Are you into whatever? What's going on?
I'm into everything. I'm totally aware of everything that's going on.
Did you watch Michael Cohen's testimony
today? I watched some of it, yeah.
Yeah, I watched some while folding clothes.
You have to fold clothes?
I do, man. That's the military in me. It's like I had laundry to do. I'm going on the road on Friday, and I said, you know what, let me nestle in and get comfy because they're going to be here for a while.
So let me. What I thought was the most disturbing thing about it was the racial remarks, much more than anything else. What were your thoughts on that?
Unfortunately, I'm never surprised.
Were you for it or against it?
Funny you would ask.
And why?
Yeah, I'm never surprised by anything that I hear, even if it's alleged. I'm not surprised by anything. And then racially, I was like, okay, yeah, it sounds about right. You know, I think
does it outrage you as an American?
It outrages me as an American because I know there are people that are going to watch his testimony. And saying, you know what, they're just trying to railroad him. You know what I mean? So instead of people dealing with the problem at hand, they're going to find an excuse or make excuses and say it's a partisan issue. And the issue is bigger than partisanship. It's about dealing with the institutionalized prejudices and racism that we face in America. I don't think we address things because we'd rather, instead of dealing with a full scope of history, We tend to, well, that's taboo. We don't want to talk about it. I'm like, no, let's talk about things and get them out on the table so that people can heal.
Well, let me ask you this. So I go through this also when somebody says something about Jews.
Mm-hmm. Are you Jewish?
I'm Jewish. So I don't look it, but I am.
Why
so,
do people always go quiet when they see the name? Are you? You know, there were some Mexicans over there.
While you're in a Mexican restaurant, right?
Yeah.
So the word racist, you know, it's used a lot. It was used to describe Nazis putting Jews in ovens, right? And it's used for things like a black guy doesn't want to pull over to pull another black in a taxi to take another black guy to Harlem. Mm-hmm. So it's a very elastic word,
right?
And that always troubles me because you begin to not know, well, what does it mean when you call somebody racist?
Right.
So I always try to think, okay, this is clearly a racist comment, but what do I think are his real racial beliefs?
Does he have a white hood in his closet?
Does he think that black people shouldn't be treated fairly for housing? Does he?
Right.
And what it reminds me most of, what Trump said, is the way that people on the left actually talk about, like, the white toothless deplorables. Mm-hmm. Like, what does it matter? Look how they live.
Right.
They're so stupid, they don't even know enough to vote for their own interests,
right,
which is what he said.
Well, that becomes very condescending.
I'm not defending it at all.
Right.
I don't like it when they say it about the deplorables either,
right,
because this is a cliche. I do think that when you dehumanize somebody in that way, mm-hmm, that is the way bigotry, then it becomes very easy.
Right.
So I think it's actually disqualifying. Like, mm-hmm, if they had him on tape doing that, I would hope he would have to resign for saying that. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I don't know what it means that he actually wants or desires for black people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that a fair conversation would think about. Like, where is he coming from? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm astounded that you're defending him.
You're joking, I hope.
Yes, I'm joking.
Okay. Because that is what happens today. You know,
I think it's hard to know if somebody is really racist or not, or if there was just a racial comment.
Right.
You know,
well, that's a vulgar look. Look how they live. Nobody would. That's
like, what did he say? Only blacks could live here in Chicago.
Only black people would live this way,
right,
or something.
Yeah. Right,
like
live
that.
This way. I mean,
something just, yeah, it's disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, even if the point you're trying to make is related in reality, to utter it that way,
right,
shows something deeply wrong with the way you,
because there's no sense. There's no sensitivity.
There's no empathy.
And empathy behind it. It's
right.
It's you've grouped people. You haven't looked at individuals. You've said, well, they. And when you say those, that's why people I think get so offended when someone uses the term those people. Because it condescends to them. It talks down to them.
I had a roommate that used to do stand-up, and he would always talk to the audience. He goes, you people. And I would tell him, I said, Dan, don't call them you people,
right.
Because it's really condescending, I thought.
Yeah.
You know, you people.
That's what it takes you out of the equation.
Yeah.
Ross Perot was a guy who put that into the lexicon. Yeah.
By the way, I heard a funny comment by one of the newscasters after the Michael Cohen thing. He said, Michael Cohen to me wasn't credible, but I believed him.
really yeah. said that?
Yeah. He didn't come across as credible, but I believed him.
I mean, listen, so the racial thing I thought was the worst. On the other things, I think he actually was good news for Trump in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, they've been talking about Russia collusion.
Right.
And he says he was there when Roger Stone called him and said, I heard that WikiLeaks is going to dump a bunch of Hillary's emails. And Trump says, well, that'll be great.
Right.
Which clearly means that he wasn't in on it.
But he did know about it beforehand.
Well, but so what? I mean, somebody told him. What's he supposed to do? I mean, if somebody, it's not illegal.
He should not be listening to anybody before the election.
I mean, some guy calls him up and says, let's be honest. Every politician will be happy to hear news. And by the way, I think there were news stories prior to that, now that I'm thinking about it, which said the rumors that WikiLeaks was going to release this stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyway, somebody calls up Hillary Clinton and says, hey, they're going to release Trump's tax returns, which would be illegal to have them. She's not going to say, oh, that's terrible. She's going to say, awesome, when do they come out?
Right.
She's not involved in it. So that was good news for him. And the thing with Stormy Daniels, too, I thought.
Do you know I was up in Lake Tahoe during that?
During
the Stormy Daniels Trump connection?
Why is Lake that significant, Lake Tahoe?
Because that's where he was when he hooked up with Stormy Daniels.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I do this American Century Championship every year up there. It's a golf tournament. It's on TV, on NBC. And Trump was there that year. In fact, we did a commercial together for the thing. And that was the year that he hooked up with Stormy Daniels.
Did you recall seeing her at all?
I saw her right before he did. So, yeah.
I'm about alley-oops right here.
Assist.
So what came out of the Stormy Daniels thing was that this catch and kill, is that what they called it?
Yeah.
Was something they did repeatedly. So it kind of detracts from the whole story that this was like some special thing for the election. And then even more importantly, what he said was he told me, what's the other Jew's name? Weisselberg. A lot of Jews in there. Oh, no, but you hadn't thought of that, I'm sure. Nobody noticed all the list of Jewish names coming out of Cohen's mouth, one after another. Oh, God. Anyway, Cohen and Weisselberg, he says, you guys, I want to take care of this. You guys go figure it out. So there was no claim that we went back to him and told him, Mr. Trump, we can't do this. It would be illegal. Mm. Like, I'm in that situation all the time with my professionals. I'm sure you are, where they say, like, I need to do this. Figure out how to do it for me. And it's up to them to tell me, no, you can't do that. It's illegal. And so I think it's hard to make the case that he knew he intended to do anything illegal.
Trump is one of those guys who does things and then apologizes later.
Like most
I remember,
of us.
Like, he put up a flagpole in California at his golf resort. It was too big. It was much too big of a pole and a flag. Put it up anyway. He knew it was, not...
Yeah, he knew it all along.
Yeah, zoned for that. Put it up, and then, once you have an American flag up, what do you tell people? Oh, my American flag is too big?
Right.
You know? Apologize later.
A lot of contractors actually have that attitude. It's better, easier to apologize.
Right.
And it works a lot of the time, because you just get it. You wear people down. He wears people down.
Yeah, he does.
But all in all, I think... this was not a bad day for Trump. I mean, do you remember what they were talking? They were practically saying that he was a Russian spy.
I love how you follow the whole Cohen thing, but you don't know anything about what happened in Korea or in Vietnam.
What's that?
Not a good day for Trump.
Not a good day for Trump.
No, he got exploded by a nuke.
He's kidding. In Hanoi, right?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah,
they are. Who's
joining us here?
That's Rachel Feinstein. That's
Rachel
a con.
Rachel Feinstein? Wow.
Do you know each other? Come sit down, Rachel. Come sit down. We have an extra mic.
What else you got on the list?
Oh, so, the other list is to talk about what you guys have in common, SNL stories, or we could talk. Now, so I got to confess to you, I don't watch any television at all. And if I had any class, I would have actually watched some of the shows
not
stuff
true.
Like that.
Not so true. You don't. It's not all about TV.
But my excuse is
it's not all about class either, apparently.
We so seldom have a guest that has his own TV show. I didn't even think of it.
It's about classy. It's not class. It's about being classy.
It's about, you know, being you and being classy with it.
I'm trying.
I'm Rachel. Very high end.
Rachel is high end. High maintenance.
If you're any more higher than Rachel end-wise.
Mental health and death and comedy. This was the topic of the week. Now, Brody Stevens died.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I didn't know him, but a little bit, because years ago he used to work here. My recollection is not as a comedian, but as a flyer guy or as a barker or something.
I think he was a barker in the I met Brody in the rest in peace, Brody, in the mid 90s, around 95, 96. And yeah, I think he was a barker. I remember meeting him at down the block at Boston Comedy Club.
At Boston?
Yeah.
I didn't even know he, like, you know, was in the New York area.
He was, but then he's been out in L.A. a long time.
He used to do that open mic at Surf Reality and
right,
those, like, weird
reality.
Underground Lower East Side rooms.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah, I always saw him as a guy who was kind of on the fringe of comedy, you know, kind of dipping in a little bit. And he was maybe, you know, something to do with sports or...
Yeah, he was a big
baseball
head.
He was a barker or whatever. And then... a week before he died, I was looking at Instagram for Comedy Store and who was on, and I just see his name repeatedly in the main room. I think, good for Brody, man. He's really moving up and really, you know, cementing a place for himself in stand-up. And I would see him at the store a lot out there, you know, and he did my warm-ups for my first special.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he's great, man. He's just like, he always seemed like a positive guy.
Always, you know, always. Like upbeat, what was his, he had a phrase. Yeah, he did have great posture.
Yeah. I would tell him the other day, I said, how do you have such good posture?
He had perfect line. He had perfect line.
Do you remember the movie?
I remember when I was on Last Comic Standing and we had this warm-up guy and he was like awful and it was a disaster because
Brody
he was like encouraging people to boo and then everybody's like, we need to get Brody.
He's the best warm-up guy.
And he was incredible. And then, you know when you walk out on TV when, you know, they make you do your walk again?
No.
And all of a sudden, well, you know, like the entrance walk and you can't be cool. You're just like, what has my elbow always done? You know, like when I've been walking, like all of a sudden you just feel completely strange doing this typically normal thing. And I remember talking to him right before I went out and I was just feeling like, you know, weird and depressed and frightened for the feedback and stuff. And he was always just like so lovely and warm. He seemed to immediately tell what you would need if you were in a strange place. Yeah. You know, he'd say your name in that loud bellowing hello. He'd be like, Rachel. And it just suddenly felt like, yeah, I'm all right. Like, so he knows me.
So do you remember that movie Ordinary People with Judd Hirsch and Timothy Hutton? Right?
Yeah.
So it just came. So that, there's that scene there where Timothy Hutton's with the female lead and she says to him, we're going to have the best year ever. And she was like really positive, and then she kills herself. Do you remember that?
I don't remember. That was just.
And I'm wondering if that's actually an insight. Like, you know.
Well, I think.
Like, it's over this overt positiveness can be a way of covering up.
Could be a mask. And also, depression is. What do they say? It's a disease where people feel like they're coming up short, like they're not good enough at whatever it is they want to contribute, and they feel like they're always letting someone down. People with depression feel like they're letting themselves down, letting their families down, and it's when you know, because
it's not a logical, rational decision.
It's just a
mental illness. It's
really
a chemical
is.
Imbalance.
Really
it's it's just not, you're not in your right mind.
Right.
Nobody in the right mind would do that.
Right.
And he talked really openly and beautifully also about being bipolar.
Right.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's horrible. That whole situation is horrible. And it's funny. I just wish he knew how many people loved him.
Right.
And cared about him and really respected him for what he did, because I kind of got that feeling since he worked late so many nights and, you know, took him a while to break in, that he felt like he wasn't good enough. But, you know, from the outpouring of love and
I know, it
respect,
really is an unbelievable. Yeah, like my mother and dad, my parents call me together on the phone to talk about him. Like, they don't even watch things I did, but they've been able to find, they don't watch anything unless it's like 7 p.m. on NBC or something.
Right.
But they called me together to be like, who, we were watching him, but I think it's gotten so far. So many people are learning about him, which is, you know, so sad, but I'm glad that he, you know, because he can't see it, but I'm glad that people are really learning about him,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I see some clips on Instagram at different shows he's on. He's hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, Nikki Glaser posted something on Instagram that was really beautiful that one of her fans sent her, which is exactly what you were saying, Rachel, that, like, suddenly, like, every single Instagram post is, like, all of this love for Brody, and it would be so nice if people did that while you were still alive.
Well, then they should start with me.
Yeah.
So is there, this is what I always think as a guy who's near it, but I'm not part of it, that I'm always thinking this must be a terrifying profession to be in if you're not famous with your own TV show as you get through your 40s. Because, like, if you're an accountant or a lawyer or own a business, like, you have a profession. Even a business is scary, but at least you have the business. But a stand-up comic, I mean, we see they fall off, and then what do they? What are they going to do?
Here's the,
and maybe just check out.
Here's the, I don't know what the word is, but why you stay with it? Because you think maybe tomorrow it's going to happen,
right?
Or maybe the next day, and I've come so far already.
But at some point, it becomes unrealistic.
Yes, but
and then how do you make
also,
a living?
But at least we're able to get on stage. So the highs of being on stage, you still have. It's not like you're waiting to perform. There is an instant thing that you get to do. You can still practice it.
And also you have to. I deal with this all the time, and I tell, especially like newer comics, you have to determine for yourself what success is. You know, because if all of us sitting at this table know comics that are uber famous. And then we know comics that are brand new. And then we know what I call the sort of the journeymen that are out there, you know, 30, 40 weeks a year, earning a great living. Like for myself, I'm not on TV right now. I've had TV successes. I look forward to more television successes. But people will come up to you. This is amazing. After a show, you just work. You're at whatever club across the... at the Rio, right? People come up after the show, man, that was amazing. You are amazing. You're so, oh, thanks. Yeah, so what are you up to? and I think any form of entertainment, you develop a thicker skin.
Yeah.
Yeah. You develop a thick skin, and you start to realize, you know, what success is. You know, I've earned a living. I've made a great life for myself at this. I continue to still grow as an artist. I continue to still earn and hopefully continue to earn more each year. You know what I mean?
So I think also there's so much wild rejection. Like, I mean, that, you know, and the highs are so high and the lows are so low. So it's like one night you might, you know, having a soft taco thrown at you in Des Moines. And that did happen.
I was going to say
it
that.
It hit like my tittage area and just softly fell. There was something. There was a sadness to the soft taco tumbling off me.
Did you ever have a prosthetic leg thrown at you, though? That happened to me.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, my
in
God.
Denver. It wasn't thrown at me. It was thrown on the stage.
Oh, damn.
Because I had a joke about losing a leg.
Oh, my God.
And the guy would not cop to whose it was. You know, nobody would come and claim it. I said, well, whoever it is, hop up here and get it. You know? But I had to, like, analyze it forensically, put it on the stool. And say, well, it looks like a hiker. It weighs about 300 pounds.
Oh, my God.
Male. You know, it had a
Did
shoe on it.
Did someone walk in, like, hop out?
At the end, they had to, one person sitting in the audience.
It's like the rat story you just told me.
Oh, yeah. I've had a lot of stuff on stage. A rat ran across the stage.
Did somebody toss a rat at you? Oh, it just ran.
No, it just ran across the stage. And people were eating. You know, it was 10 minutes near the end of my act. That big old rat came running across the stage, the back of the stage. And it was like it wasn't like a New York rat. It was like a pedigree rat, like from London. It was light brown and a little white patch under its neck. And it was huge. It was like the size of a cat. And it ran across, and people dropped their forks. It ran into the kitchen, through the curtain. People are all up, you know, talking about it. I couldn't do the rest of my act.
That was the check
spot. And then it came running out because they tried to catch it, like twice the speed, and ran down into the audience. Wherever it was in the audience, I could tell because people were jumping up on their chairs, you know?
People were scampering after the rat.
No, they were getting away from it.
But didn't they think that, no?
They thought I was a prop. They thought it was my rat, and I brought it as a prop.
They're like, come on, Kevin. Yeah.
It's funny how much people think things are planned, like the most absurd sequence of events, like that you have a rat in a plastic bag is the dumbest thing.
Truth is, it was my prop.
So you guys both worked on SNL.
Yeah.
And so what the first thing it makes me think of is this blackface controversy because SNL.
You are such a controversial guy.
I know.
Are you?
No, he's bad. Really, he is the bad boy.
Setting us up to say something bad.
We don't have to talk about
it. I actually have to do a spot around the corner. That'd be really funny if I just stayed here for the rest of the night.
He just wants us to say something inappropriate.
Listen, honestly.
Although I know this party's just getting started.
The last thing I want to do.
What about the Me Too movement?
The last thing I want to do is make you talk about something that could get you in trouble. And that is actually.
Isn't that a shame, though, that we that are so the, guarded? That
that's the biggest issue of our day. I believe that's the most important issue of our time.
We talk about that a lot, especially as comics.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Noam actually said something really interesting a few weeks ago, which is that if he drew a line on a like this is a cliff and said don't get within a foot of it because you'll fall off.
This is unbelievable the way you're
you guys say you do it. I actually think I'm improving the story, but go ahead.
I mean, my wife. Oh God.
I'll take that as a compliment.
My friend,
thank you.
My friends hold a funny joke. This is my wife. Her Native American name is Killer of Stories. Total amateur guy. So that anyway. So I said that if you drew a line down the on the floor here, and I said, walk as close as you can to that line, you would walk right up to the line, and you'd probably fall over a little. You'd have some margin for error.
Right.
If I did the exact same thing, but the line was on the edge of a cliff, you probably wouldn't get within a foot of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And because there's no margin for error. And that foot that we don't have anymore is where all the interesting comments are made, where all the funny jokes are, and we are losing all of that because we're just afraid to even talk about it.
Well, here's my thoughts on that. I think it's twofold. One, you can joke about anything, I think. It's all your approach and how you go about it.
Right.
You know, if you're talking about the Me Too movement, then you have to talk about how men are idiots.
Right.
And then I think there's some comics that can get away with more than other comics. You know, like a Bill Burr can get away with more talking about those issues.
Now, why is that?
Than some, because the audience that comes to watch him expects that.
And because I think Bill's approach, I'm trying to think of someone who's not as quote unquote edgy, using your metaphor of the cliff. Bill has, I'm actually, that's the first time I've called him Bill. I always still say Billy because I met him as Billy. Billy has always danced close to the edge to where people are used to it. And he hasn't really faced repercussions because, at least from his position and from what we know of him, he doesn't care, you know?
And he's fucking funny.
And he's hilarious with it. And he's going to, he's not going to come at the joke from the same angle that 99% of the populace is. And I think, which is really the job of the comic, is to do something with it that everyone else is not going to do.
You think Louis would have gotten away with the Parkland joke if he hadn't been in trouble?
I think he would have. Yeah, I think he would have because he's done that before. He's danced near the, he's danced over the edge.
I think you can say anything. Yeah. I agree with you as long as it's funny.
Yeah.
I don't know anymore. I don't know. But Louis previously, like he did the pedophilia thing on SNL, but he was really careful saying, I'm not saying it's me, just from their point of view. He was very cautious, and this time he's like, fuck it, I'm just gonna, he told it in the harshest way he could.
Right.
I don't know if he could have gotten away with that now.
No, well, now people are, everyone's antenna are way up. Look, expecting.
I like your line analogy, though. That's really good.
Yeah, I do too.
That's basically exactly what. Yeah. I mean, I don't see how you said that any different than I did. But
I would
fine.
Not get even near that line if it was by the cliff because I have a fear of heights.
Yeah, me too. Most people. You just want to mess
and
up.
And lawsuits.
So there's something going on.
Not me too. You as well. No, you said
that really should be what the movement's called.
Right.
Us as well.
Right.
So
that's what I said with Black Lives Matter. They should have just said Black Lives Matter too, and then they would have.
That's right.
They would have calmed everyone.
That's right. It's similar to this, and I read it just today on the way over. That we always grew up. They would always defend anybody who defended any criminal. Like if you had like Hillary Clinton during the last election, there was tape of her kind of laughing that they got this child rapist off on a technicality. Do you remember that?
I don't.
And people say, well, everybody has a right to a defense. Everybody has a right to a defense. Now, apparently, at Harvard Law School, they're calling for the dismissal of this black. He's one of the most important black lawyers in the country. He's a criminal defense lawyer, and he agreed to be on Harvey Weinstein's defense team.
Interesting.
And the students at Harvard Law School are calling for him to resign saying they don't feel safe at Harvard anymore. So this is a tremendous transformation from what liberals used to feel. They used, the guy who would take on the criminal case was the hero.
Right, right, right.
Now, nobody should defend a murderer or a rapist. Probably a murderer is okay, but certainly not a rapist.
Not a rapist.
Yeah.
I golfed with one of the guys who defended the 9/11 terrorists.
Really?
Yeah. That was, I mean, how do you do that? But I guess it's just an American, it's part of the Constitution where everybody has the right to a defense. Right.
The system depends
on it. It's
like
being a doctor, too, though, right? Like, you're going to treat anybody. Right. You'll treat somebody who...
Well, yeah. I guess in that sense, you should save a murderer. I mean, I've always been troubled. I've had friends who were defending. I said, how could you defend a rapist?
Right.
And then they get out, and you know, they probably do it again. And it takes a certain kind of... indoctrination into a certain kind of what?
Balls,
yeah. So, like, I wouldn't do it. I know someone has to do it, but I never criticize anybody for doing it. But now, as I said...
When you defend somebody like that, though, you probably don't do a lot of research. You know, you don't prepare that much. You just go in. You go, Your Honor, look, I got my work cut out for me here today. I don't know what happened, but I'm here.
But, you know, that's actually, not to get serious, I'm afraid that's not the case. I'm afraid that even if you go and say, I'm going to defend these criminals, but I'm not going to do anything from the bottom of the deck. You know, if they get convicted, they get convicted. I'm just going to give them But
lawyers also want to make a name for themselves.
You get seduced. Yeah. You got to be someone who wins. Otherwise, you won't get the clients in the future. Right. And before you know it, you're doing Columbia necktie in the OJ. I mean, they're making shit up out of thin air to try to get a guy off. Have you seen that five-part OJ documentary?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I haven't seen it.
It's on on Amazon. I mean, we knew it.
Not the one with Travolta and those guys, right?
No, it was ESPN. It's a doc. It's an actual documentary, you know.
Somebody was just telling me about, I don't know if a comic did this or what, but saying if, can I tell what some comic said, but I don't know his name?
Yeah.
Or somebody said it? If somebody told you 20 years ago that between Bill Cosby and Donald Trump, one would be president and one would go to jail.
I think it was Ted Alexandro.
Is that Ted?
I think it's Ted Alexandro. No, it's funny. Yeah. It's a great joke. Yeah. That was a set that
it's
he
not
did.
Even really a joke, but it's more of a funny kind of supposition.
Yeah. It is amazing.
You know? Because you never would think that.
All right. So SNL, which is the most interesting thing to everybody who listens to this station.
Is it? No, I'm just playing.
Yeah,
what does that stand for, SNL?
I don't know. Senile. We can't talk about the black. Well, you could talk.
Well,
about
you know what? I remember.
You could talk about it.
Well, thank you. Finally, I have some. I remember a frustration, and Kevin can speak to this as well. When you prepare for something, and it gets cut for whatever reason, and I remember one time I was really frustrated because I was told to prepare Mike Shoemaker. He told me to prepare my Colin Powell.
You say Mike Shoemaker?
Yeah, Shoemaker.
It's funny. He was a page when I was there.
Are you serious? Yeah. Wow. He worked his way up.
Yeah, he did.
That's funny. Yeah. Shout out to Shoemaker. So Shoemaker told me, you know what? Prepare your Colin Powell. So I'm doing research. I have Dean Obidala at the time worked in research. So he's getting me tapes.
Dean also a page.
Yeah.
No, right? I'm kidding.
Oh. No, but he started.
Shoemaker was a page just when I first got there, but then he moved his way up.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I'm studying Colin Powell all week, and then on Friday night during blocking, I'm excited because they're going to work on the cold open. And he says, yeah, so we're going to have you play an African delegate, and we're going to have Daryl play Colin Powell. And your sigh, it speaks to because he understands. You don't take it personally, but you get frustrated because that was the one time I was like, wait, hold up. That was supposed to be me, right? You know, and so that was frustrating. And I didn't look at it as a blackface situation. I looked at it as Daryl being the senior cast member that does a lot of the impressions on the show. But I was more frustrated, not on some racial tip, but just on some, come on, man, that was one I could have...
How was your Colin Powell?
It was good enough.
And how's your colon?
Huh? It's powerful. No. It was thorough because if I study a voice enough, I can do it. And Colin Powell, from what I'd have to hear it to do it.
Yeah.
But I had it.
And how is your African delegate?
That's effortless.
But you're right about that show. You don't know why.
You don't know why.
There's so many reasons.
And you don't honestly, you don't really get a chance to ask. There's never.
Did he darken his skin to do the?
They put makeup on him.
Yeah, did that bother you? It didn't bother you.
I was so caught up in I didn't get to do Colin Powell that.
Does it bother you now, looking back on it?
Look at him. He won't let it go. Just can't let it go.
Just curious.
It bugs me because things like that would happen where like Kevin said, you didn't know why.
I saw you coming in here tonight, and all you were saying to yourself was, I should have done Colin.
So
you know that I did the Whoopi Goldberg roast here in New York when Ted Danson did blackface. I was on the dais.
Oh, I remember that. I do remember
that. I recorded the whole thing on my tape.
And?
But it was interesting. At the time, he came out, and it was very... it was a little shocking.
But he actually was kind of being a minstrel... thing.
Yeah, he was.
He was making fun. Well, Black was the joke, as opposed to imitating doing character
and
Colin Powell.
Also, a big play on their relationship,
right? Because they were dating. I think Whoopi actually from what I remember, because I remember her defending him. And
do you do Whoopi? Do you do Whoopi?
I can do enough of a Whoopi. It's in there.
It's in there. That's right.
But something with her. Whoopi is always sort of going against the grain of what many others.
She also sounds like the woman from The Simpsons. Now I just heard it because I have headphones on.
She has a very similar to Marge Simpson. You know,
she does.
But you know, I also look at intention.
Yeah.
And I didn't look at. Looking back, I didn't look at it as. Daryl donning black, like people. Unfortunately, if the NAACP stepped forward and said Daryl Hammond was putting on blackface, I would have been in a position of thinking, well, you know what? He just did. He followed what they told him to do. They told him to. He didn't make that decision.
But can you put makeup on if you're doing an impression of a black person and not have it be called blackface?
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
So you couldn't do an impression. Let's say I did a great, you know. Whoever, you know.
Jesse Jackson.
And they did prosthetic nose and maybe, and then they put the darker skin on, and I was an impressionist.
Right.
And there was no other people there to do them.
Would that be no? Yeah, that's a no.
Well, you know what the problem people would have is why not hire someone that can do that?
But if you're doing a one-man show, say.
Right.
I mean, why? That's off limits.
No, I think then it becomes an issue of you can still do the impression. You don't have to. Like in a case where you're doing a one-man show.
What if I was playing a Mexican? I couldn't darken my skin?
Nah.
Chinese?
It's not a great idea. I wouldn't advise it.
But this is what I think about that. I think you probably agree. I think that, I mean, this all came back. When the Megyn Kelly made those comments.
Right.
And you kind of hit on what I think is an important point. She used the term blackface, but she didn't mean blackface, which, if you look it up, it means like the minstrel, like shoe polish.
Putting cork on the face and mocking.
Yeah, the point is the mocking of the race.
Right.
She was talking about, what do you want to be, Diana Ross or whatever it is. But, of course, they hate her so much, they just jumped on it. But looking back on all the people who did put on dark makeup, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel dressing up as Oprah, all this stuff. Right. And all the major networks which thought this was fine and nobody complaining about it. Mm-hmm. Oprah didn't complain about it when somebody dressed up as her.
Spike Lee must have, though.
I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised if Spike...
I would think you would have to say that this is all... We pretend that this was the standard, but there's never... It always was okay. People did... Intention used to matter, and this is a theme throughout everything in society. Mm. Now attention doesn't matter. If you're the head of Netflix, and you say the N-word in a conversation where you want to talk about the fact that we have to use sensitive language, you get fired.
Right.
Doesn't matter that you weren't calling somebody the N-word.
Right.
Just to me is
that
nuts.
I agree with. I actually when I hear I think Louis actually had a joke where he said,
Louis,
I'm not
Louis
saying,
Anderson?
Louis Nye.
You imagine Louis? He's like, yeah, guy. I just pictured that. So I just juxtapose Louis C.K.'s act on Louis Anderson. It's hilarious. But Louis C.K. actually had a joke where he said, I remember watching it on a flight, and he said, I'm not saying the N-word, because the word is nigger. And when you say the N-word, you're now projecting the thought and making me think it. You know what I mean? And so, I don't use nigger like frivolously with my friends, just because for me, I'm like, well, there are a million other words I could find that could convey the same. If you're saying, like, a lot of brothers will use the term, like, well, nah, I'm using it as a term of endearment. All right, bro, you know, bro, brother, whatever. But I also understand when people, what happens is when black people hear anyone else use the term, our antenna are up, right? And now suddenly we're like, are you saying it just to see if you can say it around me and I'm fine with it? You know, so there's that weird dichotomy that you're always constantly on guard with.
But it's also like, why do white people even need to say that word? Like,
she drives me nuts, I gotta tell you. I
it's true.
Because you don't need to say it, but because it's ridiculous that if Donald Trump was caught on tape saying the N-word, mm-hmm. that they would show it on the news and they would bleep it out, because as we can't hear it. And then they would cut to a scene of some people burning to death, jumping to their death off the World Trade Center to kill themselves, and that would be okay to see. But you cannot hear. Don't forget, we use it only for entertainment now. Quentin Tarantino movies,
Tarantino.
You know, anything fun like
Spike
that.
Spike Lee can't stand Tarantino just off of that.
And right? Of course, but I mean, Huckleberry Finn, they actually take it out of Huckleberry Finn. Never mind that Mark Twain was trying to expose mm-hmm. the racist attitudes of the South by having realistic dialogue.
Right.
Now they take it out. We can't hear realistic dialogue
but
anymore.
But I'm not talking about Mark Twain.
Anybody. Point is that it's the intention. John
Lennon.
Do
you think it was just in the South back then where they used that language?
No, but his dialect was from the... No.
Right.
But the point is that anytime you're saying something that happened or it's realistic or you're making a point or John mm-hmm. Lennon had that... I can't even say it anymore. John Lennon, it was on his greatest hits album.
Lot of people were really offended by that.
Nobody was offended. Woman
That's not
is,
true.
He went on the Dick Cavett show and talked about it. He said, woman is the N-word of the world.
Right.
But he said the word, mm-hmm. which is a powerful point. What he was saying is that the way women are treated in the entire world is the way we treat black people in America.
Right.
Now, why would you get in trouble for the way you say a deep, sympathetic point and that and any other way, if he said woman is the N-word of the world, that doesn't hit you in the gut.
See, now if Bill Burr said that, it'd be fine.
Bill Burr.
Billy Burr. No, I just love the way they have emojis. They're every race. You know, if you want to give a thumbs up.
I use the brown ones.
I go brown. I was like, okay, good. I'll press it a couple extra times.
I do like it. And by the way, when you know, like you could say bro or brother, but I could say that too to a black friend. I do think there's. I always thought
you should stay away from those too.
No. I don't
want to say brother.
If I said hey, brother, you know, with a good friend, not with anybody, but with a good friend, but never the N word. And I think that there's something very intimate. I always saw when I see it happen that I understand it. I always thought when white people say it's not fair that they can say it and we can't. I say don't be a jackass.
Well,
like, you can't understand the difference.
But and I think that also comes from any sort of ethnicity. You know, Italians, you know, can call each other certain terms that everyone else should not use.
But there is no term like the N-word.
There's not. But I'm saying with regards to terms of endearment within an ethnicity, that does happen. And you're also. You're well-rounded and open-minded enough to understand that you just said you see the intention behind it, and you don't look at it and say, why am I left out of that? You just say, okay, well, that's a cultural thing, and you accept it.
I actually am jealous of it. Like, it's heartwarming in a sense. That sounds corny. It's nice to, like, they take a word which is
so wretched,
painful,
right,
and turn it into something intimate that only we can share as a greeting.
Right.
And why would anybody object to that? You know, but anyway. That's a good point. Can you believe I'm... she thinks I'm such a right winger. So, okay, last thing. Have you seen the Michael Jackson documentary?
What a segue.
No. Let's jump right into pedophilia.
This guy.
Well, it's...
I heard it's interesting, though. I heard it's interesting.
I haven't seen it, but I heard it...
Just came out.
I'm not watching it because... One of the kids. I remember the kid when he was in the group Quo was Michael Jackson's MJJ Music, their first artist before the R&B group Brownstone. The kid was in that, and then he became a dancer, and then he became a choreographer, and he's the guy that Justin Timberlake wrote "Cry Me a River" because he broke up. He messed with Britney Spears. So Wade Robinson defended Michael Jackson years ago, and that's my issue with it. And he's dead, and I'm biased because he's one of the guys that
he's one of your heroes.
When I was a kid, he was one of the guys that was an inspiration, made me say I want to do that.
You feel the same about Bill Cosby?
Here's what's funny. I can separate. The wretched side of the things that Bill Cosby did, and I can still watch Bill Cosby himself and laugh. You know, a lot of people, R. Kelly, slightly different, but if I hear I Believe I Can, it's still a great song.
They're just misunderstood, that's all. That's all.
But this is like a really profound age-old question.
Right.
Like, so many brilliant artists are so afflicted and do horrible things, right?
Well people...
Like, are you supposed... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So are you supposed to just not listen or watch?
I think there's... First of all, just to, in case people haven't seen it, apparently Michael Jackson paid out $200 million in keeping people quiet, hush money, to stop them. So apparently he was really doing it. And it's fascinating to me how charisma overcomes even, like, the highest IQ. Like if I invited some kids to my bed, there's no story I could tell. I like sleepover. But if I'm a big, if I'm Michael Jackson, I think he's just asexual. That makes sense. I've never met anybody or heard of anybody like that on planet Earth ever. But he has no sex
drive. He had a marriage ceremony with one of them.
And then even after we knew he paid some women off. Then we found some children off, or their parents. Then we found out that he was bringing kids back to his bed again, and still we rationalized it. Or Bill Clinton, all these stories. So I find that just fascinating. But this separating the art from the artist, what I think is different here is, like, if it was just playing the song Human Nature, I think it'd be very easy, like listening to Beethoven if you found out that Beethoven... But the thing is that it's actually Michael Jackson. That's the thing. And when you're a pop singer, it's you. It's not your art anymore. It's actually you. We're fans, and we're watching the guy who did it do those dance moves, sing those songs. And that's on a whole nother level. If he was an author or just written a book that we all loved and we found out that this author did that, I think we could still read the book. But to see Michael Jackson...
But isn't that the same thing with Cosby?
Yes, it is the same thing with Cosby. It is. I think it's like you're gonna you do Michael Jackson in your set.
Yeah.
I wonder if
you do blackface.
I don't know which Michael do I do, right?
I wonder how that you must be wondering, but when that documentary hits,
it's not out yet.
No, you know what?
Next week, I think.
I still, because I don't have a bunch of jokes I do about it, but. Going back to what Kevin said earlier, you can make anything funny. If people like you, you know, as a performer, if people like you, you can say things on stage when you're in front of an audience. Because I think as an entertainer, it's your job to convey what your intention is. And people get a sense of, at least they leave your show thinking they know about Kevin Nealon. Even if you just wore a mask of a different version or a heightened version of yourself, they walk away saying, especially with comics, they do that specifically with comedians, because our job is to make things that we've said a million times before seem like it's the first time, seem conversational. You know, and so with anything I say on stage, I think I make it relatable and approachable enough so that if you do have an issue with it, you don't feel awkward coming up to me afterwards. I remember I was in Minneapolis 2 weeks after
Prince,
the police killed Philando Castile.
Oh, sorry.
Right? Yeah. You were that close.
Well, Minneapolis, you know, Minnesota. Right.
No, that was Prince. And a woman, and I was talking about it because I was talking about my position or my perspective as a young black male and dealing with the cops. And after the show, meet and greet. This woman waited, a little white woman waited until the line died down, and then she said, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yeah." She's like, "I just want you to know, I was friends with Philando Castile, and I work." And I was like, "Oh yeah!" And this is my first night. I'm there for a couple of nights, and I was like, "Oh gosh!" And she was like, "No, I know you're probably thinking, I just want to say thank you. I'm glad that someone is talking about it, you know." So I think yeah. as entertainers, it's our job to sort of push the envelope and at least push people into a place where they're comfortable having the conversations.
I don't know if Kevin.
I have no comments on that.
No comment. Okay, let's talk about something uncontroversial. So you touring the country now doing stand-up?
Great segue.
What would Howard ask? Are you touring?
I am touring. People can go to my website, kevinnealon.com. Yeah, I'm touring. You know, we were talking about this before. You know, you want to be a 40-year-old doing comedy and not sure if you're going to make it or not. I remember I used to say to myself, I'm not going to be working on the road in my 40s. You know, I'm not going to be in some hotel. And then in my 50s, you know, I said, I'm not going to be in my 50s anymore when I'm working on the road, you know. Each decade, I kept going, and I kept being on the road.
You're not in your 60s.
It. I'm 65, yeah.
You're 65?
What's wrong with that?
You don't look it.
I've had a lot of work done.
And I think comedy keeps you young, man. You're doing what you love. And
I am. I'll tell you, man. I go to bed. When I'm home, I go to bed like 8:30 or 9 every night. I got a kid. I got a 12-year-old.
I'm the same one.
Are you really?
I'm actually, I when I go on the, I actually go on the road to get better rest.
Yeah.
Right? And I also go on the road just to kind of have some me time. Because when I'm home, I'm in dad mode. I'm in family mode.
Yeah, so, you always need it at home,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
How many kids do you have?
We have two.
So, Kevin, does this means that stand-up comedy scratches an itch that nothing else can replace? Is that right? I mean, a lot of comics say that.
You're
not doing
luckily,
it for the money, are you?
I do a lot of stuff that makes me happy, not just stand-up. You know, I like to sketch, like these drawings around here. I like to do caricatures. People check out my artwork on Instagram, Kevin Nealon Artwork. I like to play the guitar and the banjo. I play the 5-string banjo.
Like Steve Martin.
Comedy is great. I love doing stand-up. I love to write. I love to act. So I think that's the healthiest for me. That's why I kind of stay so kind of relaxed, and I feel pretty well balanced as I have a lot of different interests. Right. And I have a lot of friends.
How lucky it is to like just be able to do whatever you want for a living. How many people, my father used to always tell me that, how it helped. He said 99% of the people live for the weekend.
I know it. Yeah. I feel bad for people that don't have a passion that they can pursue. Yeah. And they have to work. You know, it doesn't matter what the work is. They can work any job. But if you don't have a passion that you could do when you're not working, the best of it, you have a passion and it's your work, like we have.
Right.
And not everybody can have that. And like I said, it's not bad to have a 9-to-5 job and then have a passion somewhere else. But if you don't have that passion, you just lose that excitement in life.
Yeah. Right.
You don't have it.
I agree. And I honestly think that passion is what keeps
that's why he doesn't
keeps
look
someone
sick.
Alive, keeps you, you know, I don't believe in retirement because I honestly think when you retire, you kind of
you die just, quickly.
Yeah, you tap out. You're like, "Well, my purpose is done."
My father retired and he had no hobbies. And I tried to get him to paint, you know, because I like painting.
Right.
I got him a canvas, the easel. I even put the first coat of paint on for him.
Oh, really?
You know, I said, "Here you go, Dad. Here's some paintbrush." He drew one flower. He painted one flower. That was it.
His
kids were his hobby, you know.
Okay.
And how old did he live to?
He died 8 months ago. He was 92.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
My mother's 90. My grandmother died at 101.
Wow.
On the 101, I mean. The freeway. No, she was 101 when she died.
Longevity is very obviously. You know that it's it. I mean, actuarially, it's a big indicator of how long you're going to live. Is the longevity?
Yeah, but not always that accurate. You know, it's not guaranteed.
No, it's not guaranteed, but it still makes you feel better.
Are you at that age yet where you feel like you could drop dead any second?
Yes.
Me too.
I
got rid of all the stuff like in my closets and stuff that might they might find after I'm gone.
Oh,
like, what the hell is this?
Actually, I found when my father died, I found some stuff like that. I was happy to get rid of it
the
for
the preemptive here, let's just make sure if something happens that they don't like, yo, what was Kevin into?
Yeah. There should be a service that goes into
that
your house.
Amazing.
Didn't Harvey Keitel play that once? He does a cleanup thing after somebody's dead. Yeah, they'll go clean up everything.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
He uses the N-word, by the way.
He was the wolf. Yeah. Well, of course. It's Tarantino.
Yeah, I try to remind myself now, you have to be sure not to fall. Yeah. You're getting close to the age where a fall can be the end of you. You break a hip. And then why are you nodding your head? No,
how old are you?
I'm 56.
What? You don't look that old.
You just asked me if I was at the age.
That's a callback.
Yeah, but callback with an edge.
No, yeah, the falls are the things you got to look out for. When you were a kid and you fell, it was nothing.
No.
But now with me, because we're so tall.
Yeah, right.
It's like 10 seconds of screaming before we hit the ground.
Yeah.
You know?
You hear it all the time. Somebody maybe 56, a little bit young, but in
look
his
at
60s.
Larry Miller.
Did he break his hip?
Well, no, a couple years ago he fell, and he hit his head, and, you know, he's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he turned out okay, but, you know, he fell.
I don't know that.
You guys better be careful.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm crawling around my house.
You
now,
use a walker now, don't you?
I do.
And I have young kids. I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. And we just got back from the Bahamas.
And a 1-year-old?
And a 1-year-old.
Look at
and
you.
And my daughter wants me to go on the super high water slide. And I'm like, you know, might be a little bit too old to go on this fucking water slide where they have all the warnings about your back. But I don't want to look like a pussy in front of my daughter.
So I go on it.
I know, man. I just got back from skiing with my son. We're skiing all day. I'm getting his rental skis, you know, skiing with him. It's windy. It's snowing. And all I can think about is the bed and the jacuzzi and the bath, you know, when I get back to the hotel. And then the shuttle back to the hotel. Daddy, we play in the snow? Let's have a snowball fight. And I go, okay, let's do it. You know, I don't want to do it, but I want him to have memories of me, you know, having a heart attack in the snow.
Right.
Take a break. We'll be right back.
We're about to wind up. There is a psychology of an older dad. Mm. And you spend this time thinking about, like, well, how are they, I want to make sure they remember
right,
me. They're
right.
They're not going to have me, or maybe you have all the longevity, but my father and my grandfather died in their mid-70s. I'm like, well, you know, so I'm very careful about videotaping a lot, I even fantasize about writing them letters.
That's what I was going to say. You think about the video, talking to him, son, I'm going to tell you some things that I learned growing up, in case I'm not around.
Yes.
You know.
I thought
pretty women, because they're spoiled. You
know? Read The Godfather. All the lessons of life are in The Godfather. That's what I'm going to plan to tell my son.
But,
all right. We are out at the point where we are able to stop and have a complete show. So unless there's anything more you want to tell us, maybe you want to tell us.
I was going
to
say something, but I forgot what it was. Something about being older.
An older dad.
That's
my
age.
My son realizes that I'm older.
He does.
Then his friend's parents. And he a couple years ago, I came into his bedroom. He looked really sad. I said, what's the matter, buddy? He goes, I've just been thinking. I'm 10 now. You're 63. When I'm 20, you're going to be 73. When I'm 30, you're going to be 83. You're not going to be around for a lot of my life, are you? Tears coming down.
Oh.
And what do you say to him? And then I thought of something later I could have said. You know, look, I'm going to be around for a long time. I'm going to be around for a long, long time. I'm going to be around for when you graduate. I'm going to be around when you have kids, when you get married. I'll be around for all that stuff. I swear to God. But you got to make it happen in the next 4 years.
Yeah, and do you feel this too, that now that you know the joy of having kids, and what the fuck was the matter with me? Why did I wait so long?
No, I didn't wait. It just happened then.
It just happened.
I wasn't, I wasn't like, I wanted to have kids a long time ago, but I didn't meet the right, I hadn't met the right person.
Yeah, you could have compromised.
That's noble.
Women. You need to meet a woman.
but I know a lot of guys that before they met someone that it would have been like you did, you waited for the right woman. I know a lot of guys, egos would have just pushed them to say, well, I just have to have a kid.
Yeah.
Even if it's with the
I
wrong
I get that,
person.
Though. I don't know if that's ego or just a natural, you know.
Maybe a little both.
The way
yeah.
I don't. Do you think men are created to be monogamous?
No.
Or to procreate?
To procreate.
Clearly.
It seems that way.
Do you think women are created to be monogamous?
They better be.
Goddamn right they are. Unless there's something wrong with you.
I don't think anybody is. I think whoever made us they wanted to continue this life thing
right.
and have just constant procreation and more freeways.
The 101.
She's an outlier. But you're married.
I am married.
You struggling with it?
Aren't we all?
No. I don't struggle with it.
I love my husband too, but I think I don't think being married's particularly easy.
No. Imagine how your husband feels.
Hey, old pal.
Every time I get into a traffic jam, I think to myself, people just got to, we got to put a moratorium on procreating for at least 10 years. Just stop having kids.
Right. That's what I said AOC just said. We shouldn't have children anymore.
Who said that?
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She suggested that we shouldn't have children anymore. You didn't hear this?
Well, at least cut down the
numbers.
Don't
you listen to Fox News?
Maybe China's got the right idea. One kid.
Well, actually, we have negative population growth in this country. That's why.
Good.
That's why we need the immigrants. No matter what Trump says. All right, Kevin, it was a pleasure. Kevin, you'll see Kevin Nealon. You want to plug the Caroline's thing?
Yeah, I'll be at Caroline's this Friday, the 28th, the 29th, and 30th of February.
Caroline's.com.
You can catch
it's
me.
It's March 28th, 1st, and 2nd of March.
You said.
You just let it go right by.
I didn't pay attention to the day.
And they can watch my YouTube channel, Man with Hiking with Kevin, and Man with a Plan on CBS.
And you can catch me this Friday, March 1st at
what do you got coming
at
up
at the Improv Miami Improv one show, the 10:30 show Miami Improv, and follow my social media at I am Dean Edwards because that's who I am.
Yeah,
and you can catch me in 15 minutes at the Village Underground.
Nice,
guys. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, brother.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks, my brother.